So tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about cultivating embodied presence, or being in the body, which reminded me this afternoon when I was thinking about the topic, when I first wandered into an ashram when I was 25, when I went to the first meditation, the teacher was from Gujarat, India, and the first thing he said was, "Relax your body." He said, "You must learn to love your body." And I leaned over and said, "Did he just tell me I should relax my body?" So we're going to explore the body tonight. I went on to write a little thing of aphorisms of his, and it was titled, "Be a Wiener, Not a Loser." He said, "If you want to be a wiener in life, you must relax your body." So here's the essence of the talk. I'm going to start with the punchline. I'm going to ring the bell. And this is a different bell than the bell you've heard before. And so what you can do is sort of like imagine what kind of bell it is. Just kind of notice how hard I'm hitting it. And how long it lasts. Now I'm going to ring the bell again, and the invitation is to actually experience the bell. If you can feel the sound vibrations. We're exploring a little bit of what's called bare attention, which is rather than perceiving it through the rational mind, perceiving it directly through the senses. So you might close the eyes. This is also described as listening without a past or a future. So tonight I'd like to explore a little bit about a fundamental distinction in our practice, which is the distinction between narrative awareness and experiential awareness, and how your body can serve you in this practice of becoming free. We either live in the conceptual mind, or we can explore the non-conceptual realm of experience. So you're probably familiar with the word dukkha. The word dukkha in Pali translates as stress or unsatisfactoriness, unease or unsteadiness. And no doubt you become more and more aware of how dukkha is showing up in your life. Someone once described a meditation retreat as dukkha, dukkha, dukkha breakfast, dukkha, dukkha, dukkha lunch, dukkha, dukkha, dukkha dinner. So even in the midst of this dukkha fest, however, you might notice some settling. You might notice a little bit of calming happening. And you might notice as well that you're seeing a little bit more clearly into your reactive patterns. This wonderful analogy I find as Pat was talking last night about this steadying, this calming, cultivating tranquility. We become more aware of everything that's moving and changing and how you're relating to it. The analogy I find helpful is when you're looking out at the skyline here, and you want to get a sense of the clouds and how fast the wind is blowing, you'll focus your gaze on a tree, for example, And then you'll open your attention to the peripheral vision, the space around the tree, and then suddenly become aware of the movement. In that same way, as you have been steadying your attention through concentration, through gathering your attention again and again and again, you're seeing into the movement. You're seeing inevitably more deeply into how you're holding this ongoing flow of phenomena. I love the theory and philosophy of Buddhist psychology and philosophy, but I'd like to talk a little bit tonight as well about kind of what I think of as pragmatic dharma. How do you work with the hard stuff when it comes up? Because inevitably, as you continue to calm, as you begin to see into your reactive patterns, we'll need to draw on more and more skillful means to navigate what comes up, to explore how to be with it. And perhaps the most pragmatic view is to remember the Four Noble Truths. To remember that stress and unsatisfactoriness and unease and unsteadiness is part of the journey. It's not unique unto you. It's a shared experience. To realize there's a cause of that unsteadiness or that unease. To remember that there is the cessation, and that there's a path that leads to that cessation. And of course, it's not just a 50,000-foot view of our practice, but it can be a moment-to-moment experience. Anytime you encounter something that's between you and feeling free, there's a possibility of sensing where the attachment is, where the clinging is, where the tightness is. There's the possibility of investigating and sensing how you can soften, how you can let that go, how you can open to a greater sense of freedom in any given moment. And so our practice is to come back again and again and again. And we hear the instructions over and over to come back to your anchor, come back to the body, come back to the here and now, to start again. Every time you do, you're shifting from the narrative or the story to the direct experience. Very simple instructions. We begin to recognize that the body doesn't live in the future, the body doesn't live in the past. And any time you come back to the senses, any of the senses, you're here. You've arrived. And also, you've probably discovered that these instructions, as simple as they are really challenging and really difficult. You get identified with the story. We get pulled into the story. You may be familiar with the word Maya. The word Maya means illusion. There's a great story from the yoga tradition where Krishna is with Arjuna. And they're sitting by a river. And Arjuna says, "So tell me a little bit more about this Maya stuff." And Krishna takes Arjuna by the back of the neck and plunges his head underwater. And Arjuna is suddenly he's born, and he's nursing at his mother's breast, and he's going through life as a little boy, and he gets older, and he falls in love, and he courts someone, and he has children, and there's a war, and he goes off to war, and he's fighting this war, and then he's pierced by an arrow, and just on his final breath of watching this life pass before him, Krishna pulls his head out of the water and says, "How do you like my Maya?" We get pulled in to the story. We get pulled into the narrative. What do you imagine is the longest time on this retreat that you were lost in a thought or lost in a story without realizing it? For me, sometimes it's a really long time. I'll sit down and be aware of the breath. The bell rings and I'll realize I've been somewhere else. Have you ever had that experience in meditation when you're sort of, you're lost in a fantasy, it's a wonderful fantasy, and suddenly you realize you're lost in the fantasy, and then you decide, I'll just stay with this for a while. To me, there's a miracle that we wake up at all. No matter how long the mind might wander, there's some, that faculty of waking up is miraculous. And one of my teachers said that when you wake up out of a story or you wake up out of a thought, there are kind of two fundamental choices in that moment. You can either beat yourself up for forgetting again, or you can celebrate the fact that you remembered. The celebration is a lot more fun. So we have this instruction to be mindful of the body, to keep your awareness in the body, to let go of the story and come back to the here and now. And as you settle in, you get more and more intimate with the forces that pull you away from the here and now. And you get more and more intimate with what are called the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion, these three main forces that hijack the mind. No doubt you become more and more intimate with the five hindrances, or the five obstacles, as we've been naming them in our talks. The force of aversion, of anger, judgment, blame. The force of craving, of wanting, of fantasy, of planning, of sense pleasure. And getting caught in that vortex of anxiety and worry and the restless mind. Or getting sucked down in that sleepy swamp of sloth and torpor, of finding yourself going numb. Or the paralysis that comes through doubt, through that ruthless critic. And perhaps by now you've come to the place where you can begin to identify your top 10. I find that helpful, the top 10 or the top 5. And we begin to realize, of course, that the stories are reruns. So many of our thoughts are just reruns. So there's certain fundamentals of the practice that are very, very helpful for helping us to wake up inside the body. Tara talked about the practice of RAIN, of recognizing what's happening, allowing, investigating, the sense of non-identification. Pat talked about this amazing practice of cultivating tranquility, cultivating concentration. And they're all different aspects, they're all different skillful means that will help you to shift from the narrative or the story back to the experience, back to the here and now. So we hear the instructions to let go, to relax and to pay attention, to recognize what's happening in a sense of you can allow it. These are really kind of the components that create the alchemy for transformation. And then the question becomes, well, where does the letting go happen? Does it happen in the mind? Does it happen in the heart? Does it happen in the body? I think the answer is all three, but when we take a closer look at how your experience manifests from the inside, exploring the realm of the body in this practice can be really helpful. When you slow down and when you calm the mind, you start becoming aware of what you weren't aware of just a few moments ago. You think of it, here's everything you know, here's what you don't know, and there's a line in between. And the line moves. The more you relax, the more you pay attention, the more inevitably you start to become aware of what you weren't aware of before. Kind of the magic of the practice. And there is some gift that arrives when we encounter and we choose to investigate the dukkha as it arises. The unease, the unsteadiness, the stress. When I was 25 years old, I stumbled into an ashram. I came for lunch, and I stayed for 25 years, almost 25 years. Gave myself fully to the organization. It went through all kinds of changes, of course, over those decades, from kind of a classical ashram to kind of a hybrid program center. And over the years, through my practice, for a few years, I was president of the organization. And then at one point, it became clear that was over. I was coming to the end of that. And it was a very challenging time, even though I knew that the time had come. I was completely identified with the success of the organization, kind of being the face and the voice of the organization. And I remember in meditation, something just popped into my head. And this little voice said, within 2 years, you will look back and think of this as the best thing that ever happened. And when I talk with people about their challenges and their suffering, it's not uncommon to hear someone say, this breakup I went through was really, really hard, but it woke me up. Or someone might say, this illness made me realize what's really the most important thing in my life. Or someone who might say, almost losing my father is what woke me up and put me on this path. Or getting fired really helped me get clear on what I really want to do with my life. There is a gift that's delivered in suffering. We wake up to what is true. And the body is an amazing tuning fork. We get signals from the body all the time, and intelligence that comes from the body that we tend to overlook. You kind of think of this as this amazing customized feedback loop provided by the universe specifically for you to let you know when you're out of balance. It's called suffering. We have the opportunity in our practice to turn our attention to that stress, that unease when it arises. And the body can be the field in which to investigate. When we look at our relationship to the body, we can think about who we are as a being of awareness, on the one hand. You're made up of the thinking mind, the judging mind, the intuitive mind, and pure awareness itself. But you're also a being of energy. You're a being that's made up of sensation and feeling and emotion. You're animated by this life force that regulates your autonomic nervous system, that knows how to heal a bone when it's broken, that knows how to mend a bruise. And in this relationship of being a being of awareness and a being of energy, we of course have a tendency to ignore the body and identify with the mind. A couple of classic examples of how we tend to kind of rely on ourselves as a thinking being and how we relate to the body. You're working at your desk, really absorbed into a project. You get a little signal from your body that says, I really need to pee right now. You override it. You keep on working. At night, you get a little signal from your body that says, now would be the perfect time to close your eyes and lie down. The mind says, just one more chapter. You're having a wonderful meal. You get a little signal from your body that says, I have just achieved the optimal nutrition for full aliveness. And of course, the mind says, so what's for dessert? So this embodied presence, this felt sense of the body, a sense of grounded, aware presence, is sending us signals all the time. And we have a tendency to not listen, to choose instead to identify with the story and the narrative. There's a reading that I've found really helpful. It's written by a Chinese doctor who wrote this piece, and it's about healing and about that call, that voice to the body. It's a rather long reading, but I hope you like it. If you like, you can close your eyes. And as you listen, you might just sense your own relationship to this body. And sensing in your own way this quality of embodied presence, this life force within. I am the pain in your head, the knot in your stomach, the unspoken grief in your smile. I am your high blood sugar, your elevated blood pressure, your fear of challenge, your lack of trust. I am your hot flashes, your cold hands and feet, your agitation and your fatigue. I am your shortness of breath, your fragile low back, the cramp in your neck, the despair in your sigh. I am the pressure on your heart, the pain down your arm, your bloated abdomen, your constant hunger. I am where you hurt, the fear that persists, the sadness of dreams unfulfilled. I am your symptoms, the causes of your concern, the signs of imbalance, your condition of dis-ease. You tend to disown me, suppress me, ignore me, inflate me, coddle me, condemn me. I am not coming forth for myself, as I am not separate from all that is you. I come to garner your attention, to enjoin your embrace so I can reveal my secrets. I have only your best interests at heart as I seek health and wholeness by simply announcing myself. You usually want me to go away immediately, to disappear, to slink back into obscurity. You mostly are irritated or frightened and many times shocked by my arrival. And from this stance, you medicate in order to eradicate me. Ignoring me, not exploring me, is your preferred response. More times than not, I am only the most recent notes of a long symphony, the most evident branches of roots that have been challenged for seasons. So I implore you, I am a messenger with good news, as disturbing as I can be at times. I am wanting to guide you back to those tender places in yourself, the place where you can hold yourself with compassion and honesty. If you look beyond my appearance, you may find that I am a voice from your soul, calling to you from places deep within that seek your conscious alignment. I may ask you to alter your diet, get more sleep, exercise regularly, breathe more consciously. I might encourage you to see a vaster reality and worry less about the day-to-day fluctuations of life. I may ask you to explore the bonds and the wounds of your relationships. I may remind you to be more generous and expansive, or to attend to protecting your heart from insult. I might have you laugh more, spend more time in nature, eat when you are hungry and less when pain or bored. Spend time every day, if only for a few minutes, being still. Wherever I lead you, my hope is that you will realize that success will not be measured by my eradication, but by the shift in the internal landscape from which I emerge. I am your friend, not your enemy. I have no desire to bring pain and suffering into your life. I am simply tugging at your sleeve, too long immune to gentle nudges. I desire for you to allow me to speak to you in a way that enlivens your higher instincts for self-care. My charge is to energize you, to listen to me with sensitive ear and heart of a mother attending to her precious baby. You are a being so vast, so complex, with amazing capacities for self-regulation and healing. Let me be one of the harbingers that can lead you to the mysterious core of your being, where insight and wisdom are naturally available when called upon with a sincere heart. This is the voice of this inner wisdom encoded in the body, where insight and wisdom are naturally available when called upon with a sincere heart. So as you continue your practice, you can recognize that strong, even unpleasant sensations in the body can be a doorway to health, to wholeness, to insight and liberation. So we need to shift our relationship to the body. We see how we hold our body with aversion, judging it. It's not enough. How many hours of your life have been spent in self-criticism about your body? We want to whip it into shape. We want to burn calories, deny things that the body wants. On the other hand, we can get lost in craving in the body. The wanting, lost in fantasy, in lust, indulging into the senses. We experience sometimes the rise of addictions becomes this cycle of trying to find satisfaction through the senses. And Pat spoke of this in the Buddha's life. His initial practices were practices of austerity, of denial. Before that, as an indulged child, he experienced the other side of having all of his desires provided. And the recognition here, this delicate middle way, neither denying nor indulging. And this you can bring into the moment-to-moment experience in your practice with whatever is present. Can you be with it without denying? Can you be with it without indulging? So the body is one of four foundations. It's called the first foundation of practice. In this first foundation of practice, there is simply the direct raw data of sensation, kind of undifferentiated energetic experience. The second foundation is referred to as Vedana, where this raw data takes on a feeling tone. Three categories. The sensations which are interpreted as pleasant. The sensations which you interpret as unpleasant. And the sensations which you interpret as neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Kind of a neutral quality. The third foundation is the level of thought, the level of belief, the level of narrative. And the fourth foundation is called the Dhammas, which is sort of like the collections of the groups of thoughts, the collections of sort of the qualities of truth, the Four Noble Truths, the Five Hindrances. And we tend to commit to the mind as the basis of reality. That is the habit. And of course, as you pay attention to your mind, to that third foundation of the narrative, after a while, perhaps you begin to see the folly in that. I'm always stunned, particularly on retreats, at just how shameless my mind is. There's no little hole my mind won't go down. So I thought I would share a little reading with you, which to me just illustrates the nature of the mind. One of my spiritual heroes is Dave Barry. And he describes the mind beautifully in the following passage. I'm in an airplane, strapped into my seat, no way to escape. For an hour, we have been taxiing around Miami International Airport while lightning tries to hit us. Earlier, I was hoping that the plane might at some point actually take off and fly to our intended destination. But now I'm starting to root for the lightning because a direct strike might silence the two women sitting in front of me. There's only one empty seat between these two women, but they're speaking at a decibel level that would be appropriate if one of them was in Cleveland. Also, they both have Blitherer's disease, which occurs when there is no filter attached to the brain, so that every thought the victim has, no matter how minor, comes blurting right out. This means that the rest of us passengers are being treated to repartee such as this. I prefer a window seat. Oh, not me. I always prefer an aisle seat. That's just like my son. He lives in New Jersey. And he always prefers an aisle seat also. My sister-in-law works for a dentist in New Jersey. He's an excellent dentist, but he can't pronounce his R's. He says, I'm afraid you need a root canal. My brother-in-law just had that root canal. He was bleeding all over his new car, one of those Japanese ones, a Lexus. I prefer a Buick, but let me tell you, this insurance, who can afford it? I have a brother in the insurance business with angina. He prefers a window seat. Oh, not me. I always prefer an aisle seat. Now my daughter. And so it has gone for one solid hour, a live broadcast of random neural firings. The harder I try to ignore it, the more my brain focuses on it. But it could be worse. I could be the flight attendant. So perhaps you've been treated to that internal dialogue yourself, kind of the random neural firings of the brain. So why is the body the first foundation? Why is the instruction to come back to that raw experience of here and now? Whenever you do that, no matter how intense your blitherer's disease might be, it brings you back to the here and now. I always like to think of this sort of chain of causality. There is the experience of raw sensation in the moment. That sensation turns into a feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. That feeling, if unnoticed or unchecked, becomes a thought. The thought, if unnoticed or unchecked, becomes a belief. A belief is really nothing more than a thought that you think over and over and over again. The belief, unchecked, forms into a habit. The habit, unchecked, becomes your character. Your character, unchecked, becomes your destiny. We have the opportunity, when you come back to the here and now, in a way to kind of short-circuit that whole chain of causality. You get to see that formation arising out of the moment into a feeling, thought, belief, habit, character, destiny. So the more you begin to really pay attention to and immerse your attention in the body, the more you may begin to experience emotions as psychobiological events. You begin to recognize that an emotion lives in the body. It has life in the body. And you may notice as well that when you are lost in thought, that thought will have some resonance in the felt sense, in the embodied presence. And that can be a powerful way to move into the practice of investigation. I find it helpful just to keep in the back of my mind the sense of the four foundations. You are the body, yet the body is impermanent. You are your emotions, and yet they are constantly changing. You are the thoughts and beliefs, and they change too. And you recognize on some level the pervading truth of the Four Noble Truths, the five hindrances, all those wonderful lists, the three characteristics of reality. And I find the more I deepen into my practice, the more I see clearly into two things. That when I am identified and in conceptual awareness, and when I'm not identified and I'm in non-conceptual awareness, when I'm in the here and now, that sense of bare attention, the direct experience without adding anything to it. And you might for a moment just to close your eyes. And if you can just lift your right hand in the air. And let your awareness come into the experience of your hand. Can you feel or imagine the space inside your thumb? Can you feel the space between the fingers? How subtly can you detect vibration or tingling or pulse? Can you experience the hand without adding anything to it? And very gently you can let your hand float down to your lap. So how do we unpack and unwind this dukkha through the body? And Tara spoke of the practice of rain to recognize, to allow, to investigate with kindness, resulting in a sense of non-identification or a sense of natural awareness. I was reminded of a story someone had told me of kind of a pragmatic, a practical experience of how just in daily life this can be such a powerful thing. It was a young woman who was having a bunch of her daughter's friends, you know, 8-year-old girls, eight in her house. And it was raining, kind of like today, and they were running around squealing and screaming, and she was just about to unload on them. She'd had it. And she remembered this acronym, and she just thought, wait a minute, what's happening? I'm feeling a lot of stress. Can I allow this? She said, well, yeah, no one's looking. Yeah, let me just be with this. And she shifted to kind of investigation, kind of intimacy, and she could feel this pressure and the heat and this irritation all through her body. And she asked herself, what is this need? And the words came to her, I need a timeout. And the girls need a timeout too. And just in that pause, didn't take long, she felt a shift. She was less identified with that whole arising, that wave of tension that arose. And the beautiful thing about this story is the reason why the girls were so excited and squealing and screaming is they were making a gift for her. To me, that's the miracle of paying attention. One option to go into classic reaction in this result. Another option to stop. To ask, well, what's happening right now? Can I be with this? To turn the attention inward. New possibilities can arise. On a retreat not too far back, someone was sharing with me how he was filled with restlessness during the retreat and irritation. And he was filled with judgment from the people around him. You know, people were sneezing and snuffling, and he started getting into the space wars with someone, you know. He had his little zabuton and he you know, sort of like pushed the other guy's back and he'd bring it forward. And he said one time he came and this fellow had, like, his zabuton had come over like 1 inch into his territory, and he was filled with murderous rage. And he said he was sitting in meditation and feeling so resentful of the people around him. As Tara likes to say, the world is divided into people who think they're right. That's the end of the line. So there he was in this self-righteous resentment. And he remembered this practice. And he asked, what's happening? Just to realize or recognize what's here. And he recognized the anger. And then he asked himself, can I allow this? Can I actually make room for this? And he realized in that inquiry, it didn't feel so safe. He's kind of terrified of anger, you know, through his family history. When we encounter dukkha, stress, unease, and when we feel this combination of fear and helplessness, there is a trauma response, which is classically fight, flight, or freeze. For him, as he investigated, he saw the freeze. He felt just frozen inside because the anger, the energy was so strong. He hung out with it. He just stayed with it. He didn't try to push it away. He just tried to be with it. As Pat said so beautifully, the mind sinks its claws into something. And all we have to do is relax. And so that's what he practiced. He felt the heat, as he described it very intimately, you know, the heat through his core. The back of his neck was sweaty. The jaw was clenched. His palms were sweaty. And as he stayed with it, he asked himself, how does this want me to be with it right now? How does this felt sense, this physical manifestation, want me to be with it right now? And he got a sense from it that simply said, just notice me. And so that's what he did. He just noticed it. And it began to shift. It began to melt. And he felt a sense of ease kind of flowing over him again. And he noticed that he actually felt a little bit of compassion for the guy who was sliding his zabuton toward him. Just a little bit. What I like about that story is that there wasn't white light and bells and smells that came with it. There wasn't a flashing insight of how his father was with him when he was a child. There was instead a sense of feeling the clenching inside. the Tibetans call it shempa. It's the clenching, this inner sense that there is something wrong. And as that tension begins to build, we feel it as a wave. And as the wave begins to build, as the pressure begins to build, that's precisely when we want to get off the wave. That's when we'll spin off into anger, aversion, judgment, blame. Or we'll shift our attention to planning, thinking, judgment, fantasy. Or we'll cycle off into a cycle of anxiety or restlessness. Or we'll disengage and feel that kind of numb sloth and torpor, kind of easing our experience. Or we'll get paralyzed in doubt. But when you can stay on the wave, when you can stay with that embodied experience, on the other side of that wave will either be a sense that something powerful just moved through your system, sometimes a sense of feeling, a sense of relief or a sense of relaxation. And sometimes there can be a sense, there can be an insight. There can be some cognitive insight about a way that you're holding something that shifted in a powerful way. There are times when we feel that arising inside through the body, that unease, that stress, that sense of suffering, when it may not feel safe. It may not be the time. In which case, it's a very powerful strategic thing to bow and back away, to shift your attention, to get a cup of tea, to go for a walk. Another time when the conditions are different, you might be able to investigate that. But perhaps that moment may not be the time. However, there may be the possibility of being with it, of giving it space, letting it move. The question I find so helpful, particularly when I'm experiencing discomfort, is to ask, how does this want me to be with it right now? What that does, it can set up a very intimate feedback loop with that experience or the energy arising and moving through the body-mind. Of course, what we find in our experience, the more we pay attention to this natural unwinding, the natural unfolding that happens on retreat, is that what we resist persists. Whatever we push away inevitably will return. The wonderful formula is that pain times resistance equals suffering. You can experience a lot of pain without resisting it. The pain will be there, but the suffering will not. You can have a tiny bit of pain with a lot of resistance. You will experience a lot of suffering. When that resistance arises, it's so helpful to remember it's a doorway. It's a portal into new possibilities. I find when we are practicing this intimate investigation of what's arising, and the questions we can ask of ourselves can be very, very helpful. Martine Batchelor says this, the most important part of practice is for the question to remain alive and for your whole body and mind to become a question. In Zen, they say that you have to ask with the pores of your skin and the marrow of your bones. A Zen saying points out, great questioning, great awakening. Little questioning, little awakening. No questioning, no awakening. There are two wings to this practice that allow us to fly. The wing of wisdom, your capacity to recognize what is true. And the wing of compassion, your capacity to be with it, to allow it, to hold it in some form of loving presence. These are some of the powerful questions you can ask yourself. What is happening right now? Can I be with this? When that question is asked with sincerity, with the pores of your skin and the marrow of your bones, these two questions will reveal an infinity of experience. To drill down into what is true, to what is actually happening in the body, in the mind, in the heart. To inquire as to whether you can truly be with us, how you can hold your experience in loving presence. This is the lubrication that allows you to let go. Why don't we close with a short meditation? So if you relax, if you like, you can relax your body. You might notice how gently you might open your awareness to your body. To allow the breath to flow freely. You might sense this fundamental distinction. The awareness of the narrative, of the story. And the awareness of the experience, of the here and now. And what is happening right now? Can you be with this? How does this moment, how does this experience want you to be with it right now? Namaste. Thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.